thou will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor yourself for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, check out the link below in the description or go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you will see the link to becoming a Patreon sponsor in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are still continuing our end of the year reviews that we do every year on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. My guest again is Jerry Branum. Jerry used to be a writer for Muscle and Fitness magazine, Flex magazine, and Iron Man magazine. And now he has his own newsletter called AppliedMetabolics.com. So Jerry has a lot of experience in the sport. He's seen a lot of these competitions in person. And at the end of every year or the beginning of every new year, Jerry and I go back in time and we go back 30, 40, and 50 years into the past. And we look at the year that just passed by, but we do it in 30, 40, and 50 years ago. So we've already covered 1963, 1973, and 1983. And now we are up to 1993. We're going 30 years back. If you can believe the 90s was 30 years ago. And this will be part one of our interview. This will actually be a three-part series on the year 1993 because there was so much to cover. So in this first part of our interview with Jerry, we're going to cover all the big amateur shows that took place in 1993. So that would be the NPC USA Championships, which was won by Chris Cormier, the IFBB North America Championships, which was won by David Fisher, and then the 1993 NPC Nationals, which was won by Mike Francois. So we got a lot to talk about on part one of the 1993 in review. And then next week, Jerry and I will talk about the professional competitions that took place in 1993, including the Pro Ironman, where Flex Wheeler made his debut, and then the Arnold Classic. And then we'll also talk about the Night of the Champions and some of the other big contests that took place. And then our last part will be where we talk about the Mr. Olympia from 1993. That will be part three. All right. And at the end of our interview today, I'm going to read an article. This was sent to me by Jarrett Hulse, a big fan of the show. And Jarrett sent me an article about Lou Ferrigno going back into competition in 1994, I believe. So I'm going to read that. I believe this was in Muscle and Fitness magazine. Really good article. So we're going to read that at the end of our interview with Jerry Branum. So stick around for that. All right. What else is going on in your world, guys? We are now in the month of February, if you can believe it. January just flew by, and now we are in February. This last week, I put a new video up on YouTube. That was 1983 Part 1. Took me a few days to do it because there was a lot of pictures and a lot of video clips. So if you are on YouTube, check out my YouTube page, John Hansen, under my name, John Hansen, and then check out latest video out, 1983 in review, part one. I talk about the 1983 AAU Mr. America, which was won by Jeff King. And then I talk about the 1983 NPC Nationals, which was only the second NPC Nationals they had. And that was won by Bob Parrish. Great competition in that contest. Bob Parrish, Roy Liedlmeyer, Mike Christian, Matt Mendenhall, Rich Gaspari, and that was just the heavyweight class. So really good video clips in there. So you want you guys to check that out. A little bit different than the podcast where we couldn't put the video clips in. So check that out when you get a chance. It's getting a lot of views. All right. I didn't really get too many emails, but I did get an email on my Instagram, and it was from Phil Sharp, and I thought this was really interesting. Phil said, I have a story about the 1980 Olympia, if you're interested. I didn't hear it on your podcast. And MB John Torelli, I don't know what that means. And John Torelli can confirm it, but it is very interesting, and it involves Paul Graham and Arnold. I live in Melbourne, Australia, and I was there as a 19-year-old at the 1980 Mr. Olympia, and the booing was unbelievable. I remember everyone running down to the phones downstairs, ringing their friends, saying it was rigged. Anyway, I like your show. Wow, that's interesting, huh? I did hear there was booing at the 1980 Olympia, but he said it was unbelievable. I like the fact that he said everybody was running downstairs to use the payphones to tell their friends what happened. Obviously a different time 40 years ago, right? I did get one other email from you guys. This is from Rob Beardsmore, and Rob says, "Hey, John, I hope you and the family are okay. I had an email after listening to your last podcast as you and Jerry were talking about Mike Mentzer's abs and the exercises he did for them. Somewhere around 1977, 78, when I first started bodybuilding, I read he did leg raises with resistance by laying face upwards on a leg curl machine, hooking his toes under the pads. He'd then do a bent leg raise, which would help account for his incredible thick lower abs. I actually did these for a long time afterwards, as any young kid would, reading what the stars did, and they were very productive for me too. I love all the stories, John. You and Jerry feel like old friends, hearing your podcast over the years, accompanying my journeys while traveling to and from work. Pity nothing ever came of us trying to get Jim Charles on the show. Take care, John, and thanks for all continuing the great job on the podcast. All the best, Rob." All right. Thank you, Rob. Yeah, so that is all the emails I got from you guys today. If you guys are interested in emailing me about this episode of the podcast or any other episode, just send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, so I really don't have much for you guys. There's really nothing going on in the world of bodybuilding. The first big contest for this year will take place about a month from now when they have the Arnold Classic the first weekend in March. And I may be going out there. I'm not really sure yet. Might be doing some interviews for RX Muscle, but it's still up in the air. Unfortunately, we had a few people drop out. It looked like a really good contest. Samson Dauda is probably the favorite going in, but it was going to be a big showdown between him and Hadi Chupin from Iran. Hadi, of course, is a former Mr. Olympia from 2 years ago in 2022, and he took second last year, and Samson was third at the Olympia. But Samson is doing great, so I was looking forward to that rematch between those two guys. Samson won the Arnold Classic a year ago, so if he could beat Hadi, who beat him at the Olympia, that would be a big feather in his cap. But I heard now that Hadi is having issues getting over visa issues, so he won't be there. And then we had a couple other guys drop out, too. Andrew Jack was also going to be in it, so it looked like it was going to be between those three for the top three, and now he also dropped out. So we will have to see what happens. We got one more month to go. So we'll see what other surprises happen in the meantime. Nick Walker is not doing the show. He announced he's doing the New York Pro. So that will be, I believe, in May. So we'll see what happens with the Arnold Classic. It was a very good show last year. For those not going out to see it, you can catch it on pay-per-view. And I guess the pay-per-view this year is free. So that's pretty interesting. Won't have to pay that $75 or $100 or whatever it usually is for the Olympia and the Arnold Classic. You can catch it for free. So good idea for the Arnold Classic. All right, guys, that's all I got for your opening. So here is part one of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we talk about the year 1993. And again, we're covering all the big amateur competitions that year, the MPC USA, the MPC Nationals, and the IFBB North America. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have my good friend Jerry Branum here with us again, and we are still doing our reviews that we do at the beginning of each year. We go back 50 years, 40 years, and 30 years. And so today, Jerry, we're up now to 1993, and we're going back 30 years, which was a really, really big year in bodybuilding. So we're going to talk about the amateur shows today, and then we'll get into a discussion probably next week of the professional shows. So there's a lot of contests. I was looking over the year in review, and there was a lot of big shows. So bodybuilding was really big. Like, if you compare 1983 to 1993, man, it really grew in that 10-year period.
A really peak years for bodybuilding, kind of. Really, I mean, yeah. It goes all over the place.
Yeah. Everywhere.
Internationally, nationally, and they had a lot of great bodybuilders of that era, too.
Yeah. Yeah, the amateur shows were really big at that point, and the professional shows, they had a lot more pro shows than they did in 1983, you know?
Right.
Well, we've been getting some good reviews, too, Jared. A lot of people have been talking about these year-in-review shows, so a lot of people are giving us – I'm getting a lot of emails. A lot of people love the stories, and, you know, they love the what we're doing here.
But they like it, yeah.
All right, well, let's start talking about the amateur shows first in 1993. So they still had three big shows that were pro qualifiers in the 1990s, and those were the MPC USA, the MPC Nationals, and the MPC North America. So with the USA, you had to win the overall to get your pro card. And then the Nationals, you had to win your class. And I believe the North America was actually an IFBB show. It wasn't an MPC show. And it was a show that was with the America and Mexico and Canada, three countries. And you had to win the overall there, I think, to get your pro card as well. So let's start with the USA, because that was the first one that took place that year. That was in July. And Chris Cormier, who went on to be a great pro bodybuilder, this was the show where he got his pro card. And he looked really, really good.
As a matter of fact, there was a guy who was, this guy used to hang out with Chris Cormier and Flex Wheeler. He used to come to the gym. I used to talk to him, an older guy. And I already knew Flex pretty well. I didn't know Chris Cormier at the time. I never even saw him. And I remember right before that contest, he came up to me. He says, Jerry, are you going to the USA? I said, yeah. He says, look out for this guy named Chris Cormier. He says he's better than Flex. Right away, I was skeptical. I said, no way. I said to myself, there's no way this guy could be better than Flex Wheeler.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he was better than Flex Wheeler, but he sure as hell was in great shape. I mean, the guy didn't lie. He was phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, on one of our shows, we talked about the 91 USA that Matarazzo won, and Chris was in that show. I think Flex got second at that one, and Chris was fourth. So I guess in 92, when Flex won, Chris was his training partner, as you said, and so he didn't want to compete against Flex that year. So they put all their efforts into getting Flex ready, and then Flex won his pro card. So now 93 was Chris's turn, and he looked really – like he was so much bigger than he was in 91. I mean, he was a big guy.
Yeah, true. That's true.
But he had great symmetry too. I mean, he had really good legs. He had really good balance. And I guess you probably know this because you saw him in the gym. He was super strong, right? Like he was benching, incline benching 500 pounds. And
I didn't mention he was really strong, very heavy inclines and stuff. Very strong bodybuilder.
And legs too, right? I remember like hack squatting 7 plates or something.
Very strong.
Yeah. He had a tough class. Mike Francois, who we're going to talk about in a minute because he won the Nationals that year. He was in second place, so he was coming out strong. And Paul DeMeo was third, and Craig Titus, the infamous Craig Titus, was fourth, and Dennis Newman was fifth. So it was a really stacked class. I think there was 14 heavyweights, but there were some really good guys. A lot of these guys would go on to be pros in the next couple of years, you know.
It's funny that Titus beat Dennis Newman because in the USA, maybe a year or two later, I don't remember, you probably know, it was reversed. Dennis Newman beat Titus. It was in New Orleans. I was at that show.
Oh, okay.
That's where I think I told you the story. Dennis Newman was, after the show, was backstage. They had a setup and they were taking photos of me. He had just won the contest. Literally stepped off the stage and they were taking the pictures. And there was a girl there next to the photos. I'll never forget this. She was cursing at Dennis Newman as he was posing. And everybody's looking and said, what is her problem? She's calling him all kinds of names. And Dennison was completely ignoring her. Right before that happened, there was another incident when they announced Dennis Newman as the winner. Craig Titus threw a fit and started throwing things around the room and breaking things.
Wow.
Like I told you, I was covering the show from Weider. My habit was always to go and interview all the guys, you know, to get little bits of information. I made the mistake of going up to Craig Titus. The fit, he more or less said, get the fuck out of here. He goes, hit me. And I go, wait, Craig, because I had always had a good relationship with the guy, you know.
Yeah.
I said, I'm just trying to help you. You know, I know you're pissed off. I wanted to give you a chance to express what you think. You know, that's all I'm trying to do. And he said, yeah, I don't want to talk. You know, a day later, 2 days later, I saw Titus in the gym and he was very apologetic. He apologized to me like 100 times.
Yeah.
I said, okay, I don't take it personally. I know how hard you train for the show. You know, I know you dieted. You know what I mean? Your nerves are on edge. I don't take it personally. Don't worry, I shook his hand, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, by the way, I'm not going to visit you in prison. No, I didn't say that part.
Remember when he lost to Phil Herndon in 95? So it was 2 years after this. I think he was favored to win the USA, and then that Phil Herndon was huge. Remember? He just passed away not too long ago.
Passed away. He was a nice guy, too, Phil Herndon. Yeah.
And I think he took his medal off and threw it on the stage, and they suspended him for a year or something.
Yeah. Titus had a really bad temper.
Like
when that happened with the, you know, with the murder of that girl, I was not really that surprised because, you know, I didn't know whether he had a hand in actually killing her, but, you know, the fact that he was involved, I said, well, I remembered seeing his temper tantrums in that contest. I said, I could see it. He's got a murderous temper. This guy probably lost control of himself, you know?
Yeah, that was a shocking story, but I kind of wasn't surprised either when I heard it.
Yeah, he was a hair-trigger temper. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
A couple of guys once approached me in the gym when he was still competing, Craig, and they were cursing at him. You know, he wasn't there. They were telling me. I said, what are you so mad at Craig for? You know? They said, you know what this son of a bitch is doing? I said, what? He said, he's selling growth hormone, but it's actually insulin. Selling it out of his cartridge. I said, you got to be kidding me. He says, no. He says, I said, and I said to the guy, you realize how dangerous that is?
Yeah, right.
Growth hormone's not going to screw you up. You inject insulin, it could put you in a coma.
Yeah.
I said, I can't believe he'd do that to the guys he's working out with. And the guy says, he is.
Mm.
I said to myself, gee, what a scumbag Craig is to do something.
Yeah. Now, when did DeMeo get his pro card?
Good question. They called him Lonnie Tepper made the name Quadzilla for him.
Oh, it was the next year in 94.
Yeah, Paul was a great guy, you know, a very nice guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was tragic what happened to him.
It's funny when you look at these shows from back then, the lineup was so deep, you know, the top five or six guys, because any one of those guys could have won.
Absolutely. That's right.
And it took him like, it would take him like DeMeo. It took like, you know, probably 3 or 4 years before he won because he had to wait his turn, you know, work his way up the ladder.
He basically, DeMeo had to bring up his upper body to match. He always had the big, giant, great legs.
Yeah.
And his upper body more in proportion with his legs. And he did his tricep. People don't realize that Paul had an unbelievable tricep.
Yeah. I remember that side tricep pose. Yeah.
One of the best ever.
But out of these guys, I guess Cormier and Francois were the ones that had the best pro careers. Francois had a great pro career, but he had that colitis, and then that ended his career early.
Funny story. What year did Mike Francois win the Arnold? I can't remember. Do you know offhand?
Yeah, it was 95.
Okay, I covered that show also for Weider in 95. And somebody had told me, you know, he was backstage with Chris Aceto, who I guess was his trainer.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Somebody had told me that it was that night, the finals, was Mike Francois' birthday.
Yeah, it was. Right. Yeah.
I went up to Mike. He's sitting there backstage with Chris Aceto. I walked up to Mike Francois, who I really didn't know, to be honest with you. I hadn't interviewed him or anything. And I said, hey, Mike, I just wanted to let you know that we found out that it's your birthday today. So when you come out, the whole audience is going to sing happy birthday to you. And remember I told this story about how Steve Reese gave me that cold stare? The same thing. He just didn't say a word. He just stared at me with this look like.
You got to be kidding me.
You know what? Chris Aceto laughed. He got the joke. He knew it was a joke.
Yeah.
Francois just stared at me. And I'm thinking, geez, another guy with no personality. Here we go. But from what I understand, he was a really nice guy.
He's a really nice guy. Yeah, I met him a few times. Yeah.
I never writing on the guy, but people have told me he's a real, so I think he was really nervous and all that. And
Sure. Yeah.
The last thing he wanted was some guy to come up to him and say, you know,
right. He wasn't in the mood for jokes at that point.
I thought about it last and I shouldn't have done that, you know. When I heard it was his birthday, I couldn't resist, you know.
Yeah. Let's go over some of the other classes. So you remember John Simmons, the black guy from, I think, Detroit?
Yeah, vaguely.
He won the light heavyweights, but not a lot of big names. Rod Ketchens was second. Tyrone Felder, third. None of those guys really went on to be pros.
Yeah, I interviewed all those guys backstage at the contest.
Okay. And then Vinny Galante took first in the middleweights.
And Vinny Galante, who's still around.
Still competing in the master shows.
The show, and he's in what, late 50s or something?
Yeah, 30 years later. So, yeah, he's got to be.
He's in good shape, too.
He had a great symmetrical physique, though, at that show.
Very good shape.
Yeah.
This guy also.
And then Chris Faldo, who was a famous natural bodybuilder from Hawaii.
Yeah, I remember talking
to him. He won the lightweight class. That was his first big national title.
Yeah, I remember talking to him. Very nice guy, very personable guy. We're talking about Hawaii and all that.
Yeah. Guy was, he was super ripped. I knew Chris from back then, and a great poser, too.
Yeah, it was.
A lot of those, well, he was Hawaiian, but I was going to say like Oriental type. They're great posers, and Chris was a great poser. He put a lot of passion into his posing, you know.
There was another guy from Hawaii. I remember Alan something. Can't remember his last name.
Itonizi.
What's that again?
Itonizi.
Yeah, I think I might have been him.
Yeah.
Another guy from Hawaii who I remember competed. A very nice guy.
I think he won his class at the Nationals, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. As a matter
lightweights or something. He had super thick legs.
Yeah, very nice guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't followed him that long. He's still in shape, still works out.
Okay. Yeah. All right, let's go over the Nationals that year. So that was won by Mike Francois, and Dennis Newman took second. So Dennis really moved up from the USA to the Nationals.
One thing I have to say for Mike Francois is that he had a very complete physique.
Yeah.
Huge. He was thick, big calves, huge delts. I mean, he had a real professional level physique.
Yeah, great back, huge arms, huge arms.
I mean, I didn't really see any weak points on the guy.
Yeah. And super thick quads, too. Remember how thick his quads? The teardrop was so big.
He also had big calves, too.
Yeah, yeah.
To me, I look at a guy like that and I say, this is a guy who could be Mr. Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
He has all the tools. He has a full, complete body, and he has mass, and he's defined when he's in shape. This guy could go all the way, Francois.
And he was super strong. I don't know if you ever heard about his training.
Oh, that I didn't know because I never interviewed him. Was he?
Yeah, he lived in Westerville, Ohio, which I guess is close to Columbus. And you remember that guy, Louis Simmons?
Yes, of course, the powerlifting guy.
Powerlifting, yeah. So his gym was right out there, and he would go in there. He wasn't a powerlifter, but he would try to learn from the powerlifters, and he would train with them, which was an honor just to go into that gym because I guess it was a really small gym, and the only people that were in there were world-class powerlifters. Like, people would come from all over the world and train at that gym.
Louis Simmons had a big reputation. You know, he was very well known.
Yeah.
Kind of, what you just told me kind of reminds me of Ronnie Coleman because the gym that he joined in Texas, what was the name of it again?
Metroplex?
Yeah, that was largely a powerlifting gym.
Oh, okay.
Ronnie Coleman first got into regular training. He was more or less indoctrinated into doing heavy powerlifting movements, heavy squats, heavy benches, heavy ropes. I mean, that's what he knew. That's the first.
That was his world.
It's not like he went into a direct bodybuilding type of training. He basically did semi-powerlifting training.
Mm-hmm. And
personally, I think that contributed a lot to his gigantic physique.
You know? I do too, yeah.
He trained so damn heavy. But of course, it cost him.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the guy is disabled and, you know, he's had all those surgeries for his back. But I mean, on the other hand, from a strictly bodybuilding size perspective, I mean, I don't think steroids alone could have produced that kind of muscle mass at this
point. No, right.
I mean, he was just very strong.
Yeah. And I think, like we were talking before the show started about how he was natural when he first got into bodybuilding.
Well, John, I mean, you wouldn't believe if you would have seen him in 1990 like I did, I mean, and then see him like 8 years later, it looked like two different guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally looked twice the size as a pro.
Yeah.
So when he told me in 90 that he was natural, I had no reason not to believe it because he wasn't that big.
Right.
Muscular, don't get me wrong, was undoubtedly muscular. And he was like, you know, national level material.
Yeah.
You know? But I mean, you might remember when he first entered the pros, it might have been before he took heavy steroid. He wasn't doing very. He was like placing like 16.
Very low. Yeah. Really low.
He got on the program, so to speak.
Yeah.
Placing, you know, then suddenly go right to the top. So.
Right. But what I was saying was he was natural and he was strong and he was doing, like you said, all these deadlifts, squats, bench press. He was doing all the basic heavy barbell movements. So I think once he started taking steroids, obviously his strength's going to go up. He's like, oh, now I can deadlift 800 instead of 400, you know?
It's interesting about this, John. There's a couple of researchers. I recently read their stuff in a couple of science journals. These guys are pretty well versed in it. A lot of them have advanced degrees in exercise physiology. they're starting to write that strength has no real direct relationship to muscle size gains. I point out that, you know, some of the studies I've written about where we've talked about this, where if you do, let's say, a weight equal to 30 to 60% of one rep max, but you do higher reps, 25, but you go to complete failure, the studies show you gain as much muscle size as doing, let's say, 6 to 8 reps or 90% of one rep max, which is heavy weight, right?
Yeah.
So use that as evidence and other things to show that it's mutually exclusive. In other words, you can be, and then they point out, and you've seen this too, there are some power lifters and Olympic lifters that are undoubtedly strong, but their muscles don't match as straight.
Right.
I mean, guys can do 500-pound bench presses and they have 16-inch arms. So in other words, they're saying, you know, you could be very strong and not necessarily be big. But my personal opinion, I'm sorry, I have to disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience, my experience is that, okay, not so much now, but when I was younger, when I was competing, when I increased the weight, when I trained in the gym, the stronger I got, and I remember I was drug-free, like, you know, I didn't take any steroids. I found that the stronger I got, the bigger my muscles. I could see a definite relationship. For example, my arms, the more I could use in curls, dumbbell curls, whatever, the bigger my arms got.
Yeah.
I remember the point where I was, I got it to where I was doing 65 pounds in incline curls, the most weight I ever used. And my arms, I remember flexing them right after workout. They were pumped up. I went like this, and my head looked like a pea. My arms, I didn't measure them. I swear to you, they had to be like 19 to 20 inches. They had to be.
Yeah.
Taking no drugs, but I was lifting very heavy.
I agree, yeah.
But like a barbell curls, like 150. I couldn't even touch those weights now. But in other words, I believe, I don't buy this notion that there's no relationship between muscle strength and muscle size. I just don't buy it.
I don't either. No. Plus, what I was always taught, you know, when I was a kid reading the magazines was when you lift heavy like that, you get a denser look to the muscles, like Franco, you know, like Franco was so, he trained so heavy, he had that thick, you know, dense look to the muscles, you know.
And also, there's a, getting back to what we said earlier, there's a relationship between training heavy and retaining more muscle.
Yeah.
Because you lift, you know, you have different types of muscle fibers. They have the type 1 slow twitch muscle fibers, and you get that from using light weights and high reps, you know. Then you got the two types of type 2 muscle fibers, type, let's call it type 2A and 2B.
Yeah.
The 2A are what they call intermediate fibers. It has characteristics of the slow twitch and the fast. That's the fibers that you get when you do typical bodybuilding workouts of 8 to 12 reps. Most of the muscle growth that you see in bodybuilders is the type 2A fibers, right? However, the two type B fibers, that's where the strength occurs.
Mm.
Only way, and I put this in big letters, the only way to hit those fibers is heavy weights. You can't get any other way. But here's the good part. When you work those, if you're able to work those 2B fibers, they last a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
This is real muscle. So if you do have to pay off, you're not going to shrink down to nothing.
Right.
If you're mostly like type 1 or type 2A, you can shrink down. But if you built a lot of 2B, you know, this is the secret of the bodybuilders of the golden era. That's why guys like Steve Reeves, Clarence Ross, John Grimmick, they can lay off for months at a time and still have most of their muscle because they didn't know better. They knew, they were taught, you got to lift heavy to get big. That was the mantra.
Yeah.
You didn't lift heavy to get big. Nobody thought about lifting lightweights back then. So these guys always hit their type 2B fibers. So if they had to lay off for even 6 months, I remember reading John Grimmick writing an article where he said he didn't train for a year. And he said he only lost a little bit of muscle. That to me is incredible.
Yeah.
John Grimmick started out as an Olympic lifter himself. This is a guy very oriented towards lifting heavy weights.
Yeah.
Built real muscle.
Yeah. I think I told you that I had a hernia surgery a few years ago, and I think I had a layoff like 6-8 weeks. The doctor said, don't lift anything. Nothing heavy because you'll tear it again. You know, don't even go to the gym. And I was like afraid I was going to lose muscle, and I didn't lose anything really. I got a little fatter from inactivity, but as far as muscle size goes, I really didn't lose hardly anything.
That was my point exactly. You know, if you don't work out and you're taking a little bit too many calories because your body's used to burning extra calories,
yeah,
a layer of subcutaneous fat, that's inevitable. But the fact that you retain, you know, your strength and muscle size, that shows that, you know, you're training. And I know you like to train heavy too. Mm-hmm. You have enough of the two type 2B fibers. They're going to last. I mean, you'd have to really go a long time to lose all that muscle.
Yeah. You
know? I don't recommend this for older people because older, once you get past a certain age, then there's a real danger of losing muscle a lot faster. But when you're a little younger, you'd be surprised how long you can, if you hit those fibers, how long you can retain the muscle if for some reason you have to lay off.
Yeah, and like we were talking about Mike Francois, I mean, the kind of training he did, I guess he got really strong. Now, when you were talking about like power lifters though, and you said like a guy can bench press 500 pounds, he's got 15-inch arms. You know, but he's doing low reps. But I always read, like this is again going back to like when I was 15 years old and I was reading the magazines, they said the more weight you can use for like 6 to 8 or 6 to 10 reps, the lower, kind of the moderate lower reps, the more weight you could use for that, that's what's going to really increase the muscle size.
Yeah, it's because I think it's also because you're hitting the 2B fibers more with a slightly more reps.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking about the 15-inch arms who can lift like heavy bench and stuff. That's a neuromuscular effect more than that. But those, these guys through regular training and doing maximum lifts have developed extremely good neuromuscular connections where they're actually able to activate the muscle more. And that's what accounts for their strength. This explains why Franco Colombo was, you know, pound for pound was stronger than Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
But had a great deal more neuro, and he also had the short limbs. He had more neuromuscular connections than Arnold would be the first to admit it.
Yeah.
Franco had tremendous neuromuscular connections that made him very strong.
Yeah. 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 I guess, well, Mike Francois, I guess he was training, learning these power lifts, but then when he went to his bodybuilding training, you know, he was able to squat like 600 for 8-10 reps, you know, and then I guess with his training, he was going fast. Like he was using these super heavy weights with like only like a minute and a half rest in between, you know, sets. So I never saw any videos of his training, but man, it sounded brutally hard. So I was glad when he started winning contests because I was like, this guy puts in the work. You know, you could tell with his physique, he had to, even like his back had those thick spinal erectors. So you could tell this guy was a heavy trainer, you know?
That's true. But I think this guy, by doing that powerlifting stuff, he really built out the foundation. So just like Ronnie Coleman did. So he went into strict bodybuilding training. It was comparatively easy for him to build up even more muscle.
Yeah.
Great foundation to begin with from doing those heavy lifts. So, but as far as resting a minute, you know, scientifically, excuse me, that's not the best for building strength and muscle size.
No, right. Yeah.
They found is if you really, and this goes for anyone listening to this, if you really want to increase muscle size, you want to rest a minimal 2 to 3 minutes between sets. And there's a good reason for that, because when you do a set, you basically temporarily exhaust the energy supply of the muscle, including creatine, ATP, and you cause these fatigue acids to build up, right? If you don't give the muscle enough time to recover, the muscle can't completely regain its strength.
Mm-hmm.
We regain strength, you're not going to get the maximum intensity. So if you're interested in especially strength, you want to rest 2 to 3 minutes between each set. In full disclosure, I break that rule every time I train because I get to the gym late. I have to rush through my workouts. Vince Garanda put me on when I joined this gym, I told him I wanted to put muscle size on. He put me on what he called the 6 times 15, something like that. I don't remember exactly, but he had me do one exercise for six to seven sets. But here's the key. I only rested 15 seconds between.
Oh, man.
Myself, remember, I was doing like 20, 25 sets. I said, Vince, 6 sets? How are you going to go from 6 sets? He said, just try it and you see if it's easy. John, I'm telling you, after by the second or third set, my muscles were dead.
Wow.
I couldn't recover at all. I forced out the sets. By the sixth set, I was down to like 3 reps. I mean,
yeah, muscle. Yeah, right.
I was only resting 15 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
That was an early indication of the importance of rest between sets.
Yeah, I think when Mike said that, I think he was already like super strong. So then he was just able to like make his training more intense. But I do remember reading an article about him when he first joined that Louis Simmons gym, and he was used to just doing bodybuilding training, and they were showing him how to get stronger. And whoever was coaching him said, just rest, hold on, wait, you know, don't rush to your set. He had to learn to wait, like a powerlifter did, you know, to increase his strength, you know.
Well, I'm sure the powerlifters knew this just from experience.
Yeah.
Now, even before these science studies came out, they probably noticed that if they rested longer between sets, they were stronger on the next lift. So that's how probably they knew it for years.
Yeah.
Just like bodybuilders, you know, are way ahead of the general public in a lot of different things. Like bodybuilders were the first population to start low-carb diets before any of these other people came out. They were doing it in the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Were the first to do crunch sit-ups, short-range sit-ups. Now everybody basically does sit-ups like that.
Mm-hmm. So it
started out in bodybuilding that, you know, trickled down to the public.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I don't know the point I'm trying to make.
Well, yeah, it's the experience. We have the experience.
Kind of learn this by experience.
Trial and error, yeah.
Experience and you learn, you know, by it just, you know, dawns on you that this is what works.
Yeah. I mentioned Dennis Newman got second in this class in 93 at the Nationals, but the guy who was third was Edgar Fletcher.
Oh, yeah, Edgar Fletcher.
And I was reading an article about the USA that Cormier won, and they said in the article that after the prejudging, it looked like Edgar Fletcher was one of the top guys in the show. But they said as he posed, he was like fading. And then they said after the prejudging, he was cramping up really bad. Wow. So they were going to give him potassium. And he said, no, that somebody like you, you know, you said, Jer, don't give him potassium because he's taking these potassium sparing diuretics.
Right. Edgar Fletcher is one of those guys who they call the, you know, he should have been a pro in this.
Yeah.
And that.
Yeah.
Potential. And he really was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of burned out, I guess, after a while, because he wasn't really happy with the way he was placing, you know. But
yeah,
the cramping and stuff tells me that he must have done something wrong. He must have been severely dehydrated. He had probably an electrolyte or mineral imbalanced.
Mm-hmm.
Might have taken some diuretics that drained out his minerals or something like that.
That's what it sounded like.
There's always a reason to explain that stuff.
Yeah, so I guess he didn't even finish that contest at the USA. He was one of the top guys, and then he never finished. So he did come back at the Nationals, but he got third. And Don Long, who went on to win the Nationals a couple years later too, he got fourth. So just goes to show you how incredibly competitive these shows were back then, you know?
Yeah.
The light heavyweight winner was Daryl Stafford. So he did. I think he was a great light heavyweight for years. Remember when Sean Ray was winning it and, you know.
He passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he passed away too, yeah.
He wasn't very old either. I don't know what happened to him.
And he did turn pro, but he never did anything as a pro.
No, didn't do anything, that's right.
I think he was from Florida, so.
Right. Nice guy. Quiet guy, but nice guy.
Robert Mello was the middleweight winner. I don't think he ever did anything as a pro. But this was before they had 212 and everything, right? So these lightweight guys, they really had no shot at the pros. I mean, they were.
There's an old saying that, you know, a bigger guy is always going to beat a smaller guy. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's like, and Franco used to always complained about that, you know, he felt that he had more muscle than Arnold.
But yeah.
Arnold beat him or placed higher because he was bigger, taller, you know, and this and that.
Yeah.
And there's some credence there. I, for years, when I was writing for the magazines, I always used to say, listen, they should have different divisions, especially in the pro shows. I mean, because, you know, the smaller guys, as muscular as they are, they're not going to beat the big guys. It's not going to happen.
Right.
So you need a separate lightweight division. And I think I told you, they used to have those silly press conferences before the Mr. Olympia. At one year, it was right around that time, the early 90s, I raised the question. I raised my hand and I said, I want to direct this at the whole panel, meaning all the guys who were competing were all on stage there. I said, how do you guys feel about creating a lighter weight class, separate class? I think they had it for a while in the Mr. Olympia. And they, you know, they had like a what is it? I can't
remember. Under 200, over 200.
Got rid of it, you know. And what do you think about bringing that back? You know, to give you guys a chance. I mean, and I'm looking at Sean Ray and Lee Labrada, who are sitting up there on the stage, and I'm thinking these two guys can win the Mr. Olympia themselves. They were Mr. Olympia material for sure. Yeah. I said if they had a separate division, they would easily win it, right? And so who answers but my good friend Sean Ray, you know? And Sean Ray, he says, I don't like the idea of a separate division. He says, because I'm paraphrasing, it's not exactly what he says. He says, because there should only be one Mr. Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a separate division, kind of takes away a lot of the prestige of having the Mr. Olympia title. So I'm against it. And Labrada agreed with him.
Yeah.
Surprised me. I'm thinking, don't these guys realize I'm trying to help them? I didn't want to say in public, but guys, listen, as great as you are, Sean and Lee,
yeah,
to beat Lee Haney and Dorian
Yates, yeah,
it happened.
Yeah,
don't you want some Mr. Olympia title?
Yeah,
I want to wait for the Masters, Mr. Olympia. That's another
right. Yeah, and I thought Sean should have won that '94 Olympia.
Yeah, where was that held? Can you remind me?
That was in Atlanta. That was the year that Dorian tore his bicep.
Yeah, that's right.
And Sean was really, man, I think that was the best he ever looked.
I think he pushed him in the Helsinki contest, too.
Yeah, I do, too, yeah.
I remember after the contest that year in Helsinki, I think it was, what, 90? Was that 91 or 92?
It was 92.
I remember his brothers were just fuming. Oh, man, were they, I thought they were getting a fight. One or two of his brothers were there. They were just fuming.
Plus, they gave him fourth. He didn't even get second. He got fourth.
That's what also made them mad. Yeah. Sean, but his brothers were the ones that really were pissed off.
Yeah.
Pretty mad.
So the other one I want to talk about, the other amateur show, was the IFBB North American Championships. And that didn't have the lineup that the Nationals or the USA did. David Fisher won. You remember David Fisher from Canada?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. I think now Dave has a gym in California, a powerhouse gym.
He does have a gym, and he married a top female bodybuilder whose name, maybe you remember her name. I can't. I think she actually won the Nationals, female Nationals.
Yeah, Sue, right? Her name was Sue?
Yeah, I think that's it. She was a top bodybuilder herself.
Yeah, yeah.
He's another guy I never interviewed, Dave Fisher. I don't really know him. I do remember, what exactly happened. I couldn't tell you the context, but I remember him being kind of unfriendly.
Mm.
I might have tried to interview him, and he was kind of, not very friendly. A vague recollection of it. He wasn't the friendly. He's probably a really nice guy. But like I said earlier, you never know. When these guys train for a show, the drugs, the diet, the nerve, it can affect your personality where you're not And, if you catch him at that time, you can get a bad impression of him. If you catch him at a different time, that people tell me that, for example, Sergio Oliva Sr. was a really nice guy. They like him. To me, he was a bastard. He was, every time I met him, he was nasty. But, that's just me. It might have been, again, maybe I could caught him at a bad time.
Probably dieting, yeah.
A couple of times he was not in a contest. That explained that Sergio Jr. told me that his father was very moody.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a bad mood. He was very nasty.
Yeah.
I said, that way to you? He says, yes.
Yeah.
That's his personality. He could either be a really nice guy or just a really moody prick.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the drugs because I knew a lot of guys. I worked out in all these hardcore bodybuilding gyms for years, and guys' personalities would be completely different. I mean, if they were getting ready for a contest or even in the off season, if they were on drugs, they were assholes, and then get them off a cycle and wow, it's like who's this guy? I mean, it's like a totally different personality.
Everybody who diet, the diet and the dieting is hard enough, the dieting and the training. But if you add steroids to it, now you got a real personality change. Now you got something called roid rage, which is a big debatable thing. I was about roid rage. My conclusion is that it's more or less like, they point out how steroids are supposed to increase aggression the reason there's men have wars instead of women is because men have more. You hear all this stuff, and that's an that's how they're trying to explain roid rage. When you take a form of testosterone, whether it's testosterone itself or anabolic steroids, it increases the aggression and rage and all this.
Yeah.
But it shows that they found that the angriest of men, this is going to surprise you, the men with the most resting rage, I call, where they're mad all the time, like mad at the world, they have the lowest testosterone levels.
Oh, really?
Surprising when I found that out.
Yeah, that is surprising.
Second thing I realized is that steroids only emphasize what's already there. In other words, if you're a nice guy, basically a nice guy who treats people well, you're going to get irritable on steroids. Yes, you will. That's unavoidable. But you're not going to turn into a monster.
Mm-hmm.
But a trick to start out with, you're going to be when you take the steroids.
Right, right.
It's the truth about roid rage.
I believe that because I knew a lot of guys that probably didn't have the greatest personalities or weren't the nicest guys. And when they got on drugs, they were just real assholes, you know.
Emphasizes that. That's what they used to say about marijuana.
Yeah.
If you smoke marijuana, if you're already in a good mood when you start smoking, you get in a better mood. You get happy. But if you're in a bad mood, it can make you worse where you want to just like get really pissed off and irritable.
Yeah.
So that's the way some of these things work, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then the lineup in that show, Stan McCrary. You remember Stan McCrary? Pretty big black guy. He was in second. That's probably the best Stan ever did. I think Stan did that in North America several times. I see Stan at the Florida shows. He's always around. He's still in the industry.
Still in shape?
Yeah, still pretty big guy. Yeah, he's real good friends with like Dexter and a lot of the pros. You know, the light heavyweight was Matt McLaughlin, who I really don't remember that much. The middleweight was Darren Mead.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of names here. It's weird how big the Nationals in the USA was, but the North American, even though you get a pro card, it didn't have the same names, you know?
I'm not sure if this was the 93 North America?
Yeah.
Who won that again?
Dave Fisher.
That wasn't at that show. That's why, see, as you're reeling off these names.
Yeah.
Remember, I told you when I used to go to the big shows for Weider, I would interview the top six of every class in all the shows.
Yeah.
Naming these names, I'm thinking, I don't remember this guy at all. Now I realize why, because I wasn't at that show.
Yeah. I want to mention the World Championships, which I think were still being drug tested, weren't they? The IFBB World Championships?
Yes, they were.
But that's kind of debatable, right? I mean, these guys didn't really look drug-free, you know?
By that time, they had figured out a way to beat them.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So Gunther Schlierkamp was the heavyweight winner. So that was how he got his pro card.
Was that Gunther's initial introduction to?
I believe so. Yeah, yeah. Because I remember him competing in some of those shows in the 90s as a pro, and he was still much smaller than he became later on. You know,
Gunther will always have a distinction in bodybuilding history as being the only bodybuilder to beat Ronnie Coleman.
Yeah.
That Ronnie Coleman won the Mr. Olympia when he was in top shape.
Right, right.
Bodybuilder that can say that.
I was there at that. What year was that? That was 2002, I think. Yeah. And I went to that Olympia that year in Vegas, and man, Gunther looked amazing at that. He was just, you know, we always talk about every once, like, there's always one contest where a bodybuilder will just peak perfectly. He was so peak, like, everything, his tan, his size, his cuts, and it was weird too because he wasn't supposed to be one of the top guys at that show. But when he walked out to do his routine, it was like the whole audience just got caught up in it.
Was this the same year that he beat Ronnie? That same
yeah,
year?
Yeah. Because he ended up getting fifth in the Olympia. But I'm telling you, the whole crowd was behind him.
Well, I'll tell you something now that the first year that I wrote, that I started my Applied Metabolics publication.
Yeah.
2014, if I remember correctly. I got a hold. Somebody gave me a fax that basically outlined Gunther's entire drug and diet program that he used for those contests. So I knew Gunther by then. You know what I mean? And I what I did is I wrote, I said, I titled it, What the Pros Really Use.
Wow.
Wrote an article, and I explained every one of all the reasons, you know, the drugs use, how they work, why it would be included. I did an entire article, but I never identified him. All I said was he was a top five Olympia finisher. And I said, he was in the best shape of his life when he used this program. That's all I wrote. I didn't want to embarrass him. You know, I wouldn't do that. But
was it a lot of stuff?
Oh, geez. Ending the article by saying, I said, listen, anyone reading this who competes, don't even think of trying to emulate this. I said, because it would probably either put you in the hospital or kill you.
Yeah.
It was a horrific, horrific drug program. Horrible. Wow.
Yeah.
Horrible in the sense that it was bad for me, but as far as from a health point, very risky. Very risky.
Yeah.
You know, and Gunther himself, I remember him coming up to me not long afterwards. He had just met, he started going out with a female bodybuilder whose name again escapes me. And I guess he married her.
Oh, yeah.
And they wanted to have a child. And apparently he was infertile. From taking all that shit, he was completely infertile. Oh, yeah.
That must happen a lot, right?
Yeah, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
Is there anything I could do to increase my sperm count? You know, I want to get my wife pregnant. So I gave him a couple of tips about, you know, I mentioned a certain hormone that usually they give to women that would, you know, that it's a fertility drug. I said, but in men, it has a pretty powerful effect at increasing sperm count. I said, because he hadn't taken that. He'd been taking other stuff, but it wasn't working. I said,
Is that HCG?
No, it was HMG, human menopausal gonadotropin.
Oh, okay.
It stimulates the what's it called again, the Sertoli cells of the testes, where sperm is in women it stimulates like egg production, all that stuff. But I said try it. Now he never got back to me, but coincidentally, I'm not saying it was me. 9 years later, his wife gave birth.
Yeah.
Honestly, I honestly don't know whether he took my advice or not. I just found that it's interesting that 9 months later, his wife birth, you know, so
right.
Happy for the guy. What can I say? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Kim Lyons was her name.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Luther was a good looking guy. I mean, he.
Oh yeah. And now there's a guy, you know, we're talking about roid rage. That guy was always in a pleasant mood, always smiling. He was amazing.
Never added. Yeah. He's an example. In other words, he was a nice guy, whether he was on drugs or not. And no matter how, I mean, the drug, let me put it this way. The drug program that I wrote up that he used, if you give that to a guy like Craig Titus,
yeah.
These six murders, you know. Well, but you give it to Gunther, hey, how you doing? Nothing. No chance.
No, nothing.
Guy, you know.
I've never seen that guy not smiling, you know.
Always.
Whether he's in a contest or he's at an expo or whatever, I mean.
Always nice to be, very personable guy, very nice.
Yeah. That's why he was so popular. People love him. I mean, he was a good-looking guy, tall. I mean, he had a great look, you know, great look for bodybuilding.
Really, I think he was, for a while, he was trying to get into acting or something. I don't.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah.
I think it went anywhere. He dropped a lot of weight. But, I mean, He had sport. He was tall. He was a very good-looking guy. When I looked at his face one time, he reminded me, if you ever look at photos of John Wayne, famous John Wayne actor, mm-hmm. Young man, you know, and you look at Gunther, they had a little bit of a resemblance.
Oh, really?
John Wayne was a handsome guy when he was a young guy, you know.
Yeah.
Old, handsome guy. And Gunther looked a little bit like him, you know. So when I heard he was trying to be an actor, I said, okay, so he has an accent. I mean, didn't seem to hurt Arnold. You know, maybe, there's a break, see? See, the thing about Arnold, I don't mean to get off the topic. You know, Arnold has this new book we talked about. You know, it's basically an inspirational book. Basically, he wants to outline the secrets of his success, you know, how he, you know, accomplished all he did. Now, that's all true. I'm not saying that if people don't follow those rules, so to speak, that it is going to definitely help them because it gives them confidence. You know, it lets them, you know, everyone experiences failure, but if you have type of principles in mind, you'll overcome the failure and keep going. So that part is true. The part that Arnold doesn't talk about is that there was a strong element of luck.
Yeah.
Happened to be in the right place at the right time. And what I'm saying is, even if you follow all the principles Arnold talks about, unless you're lucky,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to emulate a guy, the success of a guy like Arnold.
Yeah.
I could say the same thing about other people. Elon Musk, richest guy in the world. He happened to be certain circumstances. He happened to have a way. Him and his brother started a small online thing. They had an opportunity to get into PayPal, and that's what started him. It just happened. Thing, and now he's the richest guy in the world. If he didn't get early opportunity, I'm not saying he wouldn't have been a rich guy anyway, but he certainly wouldn't have been worth $225 billion. I mean,
there's
an element of luck, you know, and I'm not trying to disparage anyone. But, you know, it's like you always have to realize there's an element of luck. You know, you just have to be in the right place at the right time. You know, there's a lot of people that do everything right, and you know this. I've seen them. I mean, I've seen actors, for example, who do everything right. They take acting lessons. They do stage plays. They get, you know, they get the 8x10 glossies. They get an agent. They never go anywhere. Nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying they get nothing. They get maybe a commercial here or there, small part in a movie. You never hear of these guys.
There's like got to be some incredibly talented actors out there doing some small play that you never heard of. You know?
Oh, yeah, there really are.
Or musicians or whatever.
But the problem is they just don't get a break. In other words, sadly, is not on their side. You know what I mean? That's just the way it is.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this with Arnold when we were talking about his documentary. But, you know, you look at what happened with him. You had Charles Gaines and George Butler do that book, and that's what really launched him. And then they did the movie. And also, Charles Gaines wrote the book Stay Hungry, and then they made that into a movie, and then he pushed for Arnold to be in the movie. So if he didn't have all that, and then you also had Joe Weider, right?
Joe Weider, you know the famous story how Joe Weider talked these producers into using Arnold for
Hercules movie, yeah.
Famous Shakespearean actor in Europe, you know, he bullshitted his way in, you know. But of course, you can't discount the fact that Arnold had a unique personality too.
Yeah, for sure. Because if you look at, I think that definitely helped him in Hollywood. Because there's certain people that are just charismatic, and I know people like that, and they just draw people to them, and people want to help them. You know, like I have a friend of mine's like that, and he just everybody he meets, big people in the industry, they're just like, how can I help you? How can I? Because the charisma helps up. You know,
a lot of people like that, and Arnold. You know, he was kind of like people would look at him. They see this big giant bodybuilder and they expect this dumb guy who can't talk, who's like a narcissist or something like that. Instead, the guy who's making fun of himself and laughing and joking.
Charming. Yeah.
And he disarmed them. And the thing is, that helped him a lot. I mean, kind of, hey, this guy is, you know, we could use this guy, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
He still had to have an element of luck just to get into the situations that off him, so to speak. If he wasn't in the right place at the right time, I don't know. Arnold's a pretty industrious guy. He probably maybe would have stayed with the business stuff, you know, the real estate. He'd still be a wealthy guy, probably.
Sure.
Arnold, one thing about him, he was always very, very ambitious. I know him well enough to say that this guy is extremely ambitious.
Yeah, he could have started his own line of gyms or the magazine business or something, you know.
Would have succeeded in just about anything he did. But, you know, again, the element of luck was needed to get as far as he did to the point where he is now, you know.
I don't want to get too metaphysical, but do you think, you know, you always hear about if you visualize something, then the universe lets it happen. You know, I mean, he was always a big believer in that. Do you think that because he visualized himself as a Hollywood star that the pieces kind of fell in place as his life went on?
I think he talks about it in his book. I think there's some truth to that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, Zane used to do that, too. We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Visualize himself, you know, winning the Mr. Olympia. He'd repeat these mantras over and over again. I will be Mr. Olympia, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it does is subconsciously gives you this tremendous self-confidence, you know, where, you know, you just, you know, you can't get discouraged. You're basically immune to negative influences.
Because you've already seen it.
You've already seen yourself winning. So, you know, how could you not win?
Yeah.
So that does play a definite role. I think there's no question about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. On a smaller scale, I always, like, I do coaching, you know, and try to help people get in shape. And I noticed that a lot of people, when they start a fitness program, especially people who aren't used to working out like you and I are, you know, it's something new for them. They look at it as like a burden. They're like, oh, I got to go work out. I got to eat these foods, you know, and they're like really negative about it. And what I noticed Arnold always did when he was getting ready for these contests was he would always visualize himself as the winner already, you know. So then when he had to go through all that training and all that dieting, it was no problem because he was focused on winning the contest. He knew why he was doing everything, where I think a lot of people who don't have that goal in mind, they don't see themselves as the finished product. Yeah. You know, that's what they struggle with, the day-to-day thing, because they're not seeing the long-term goal, you know.
And in the bodybuilding, there's another factor, is that if you visualize yourself as already winning the contest, you can't be intimidated by, let's say, competitors.
Yeah.
Remember the famous scene in, I think it was Pumping Iron, where was it Eddie Julian? Somebody says to Arnold about Lou Ferrigno is he's gay, he's really big, and Arnold just, you know, he just,
yeah.
I'm ready, you know, I'm ready for him. And,
I've already won.
In other words, Arnold cannot be intimidated.
Right. You know,
somebody came up to Arnold and said, hey, Sergeant Bray, he's looking really good, or this guy, that guy, or Sergio Oliva, wow, he's gigantic, he's a freak, this and that. Arnold, he already saw himself winning.
Yeah.
That stuff to one ear and out the other. It just, you know, so that's where the visualization, it's a tremendous self-confidence tool.
Yeah.
Self-confidence really is important for any type of success in any endeavor, whether it's bodybuilding or business or even personal relationships.
Yeah.
Self-confidence makes a huge difference. Very important.
And I think in bodybuilding, because it's subjective and you just have a bunch of judges giving their opinion, and they're prone to being subjective, you know, to being influenced, I guess. So if you get a competitor like Arnold who gets up there with all this confidence, he can't see any other outcome except him getting first. That translates over to the judges, you know, and that has an effect on the judges, you know.
It does. I mean, like when Arnold was posing, it's like, you know, like he's saying, look at this. I already won, you know, just it's over with. And I think
like it's almost hard for the judges to put him in second. I got you know.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like how even the audience can influence the judges, you know?
Yeah.
66 Olympia, when Larry Scott got the 20-minute standing ovation.
Right.
I don't think that influenced the judges.
Right.
In a situation like that, think about it. How could the judges possibly let the man who got second win? They couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Couldn't do it, even if they thought Harold Poole was the better man. Just the mere fact that that Scott was such an audience favorite, Poole had no chance of winning.
Yeah.
None.
Yeah, we've talked about the 80 Olympia so many times, but I think there was a guy, was it Vince Basile, I think, from Australia. He was at the 80 Olympia in Australia, and he was taking all these shots, you know, and he was so busy, like, taking the pictures, and then he was watching the contest and taking pictures, you know. So he said when he was watching the show in person, he had Arnold in first place. Then when he got home and he studied the slides, he had him like in fifth.
Right.
So it was the influence Arnold had, you know, his charisma and everything made a difference with where you were going to place him, you know.
Sure. You know, when Arnold's posing, when he does those, you know, twisting back and he shows that giant bicep and the huge, you know, you kind of like focus. It's like I said with Larry Scott when we talked about him a while back, I pointed out how Scott was very masterful in his posing. Because he had a very weak back. He didn't have any wide lats. He had narrow shoulders. But what he did is all his poses emphasized the absolute tremendous shoulder and arm development he had. So he kept going like this. When he do a back shot, he twists and show his arm.
Yeah.
You know, it was arm and shoulder.
Right.
Focus and say, look at this guy's physique. But you were looking at his arm and shoulders.
Right.
His torso was mediocre and he had no back and his legs. You keep looking at those unbelievable shoulders and arms, and that made him win. And that's what happened with this guy, Vince. I mean, he's looking at Arnold Post, seeing that arms.
Yeah.
I wasn't at that Sydney Olympia, but even in the photos, when Arnold flexed his arms, I have to admit, I think anyone would agree, he did make the other guys look like tiny little guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He approached his arm development.
Right.
Focus on that. It kind of hypnotizes you into thinking, oh, yeah, Arnold just won again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really break it down like afterwards and look at the photos, you realize Arnold was not at his best.
Right, right, right.
So it's like a trick people do on themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There, one other show I wanted to mention before we go talk about the pros, Jared, was the Teenage Nationals, the MPC Teenage Nationals. And that was notable because two guys that went on to become really good pros, Branch Warren and Jay Cutler, both won their classes. Branch Warren won the overall, but Jay Cutler at 19 years old won the heavyweight class. And man, you could see this guy was going to be a pro bodybuilder only at 19, right?
Yeah, that's the year I met him. I did that little article on him in Flex.
Yeah.
I could see the potential. This guy definitely had pro potential. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Especially his legs. He had Jay always had those crazy sweeps. It doesn't even look real.
And not only that, he had like cross cuts in his quads. We don't see that often in big guys,
Yeah. I mean, he probably had better legs at 19 than most guys will ever develop in a lifetime of training,
I remember commenting to him. I said, Jesus, I said, I never had legs like that.
Yeah.
I remember telling him that.
Me neither. I remember when he won the Nationals and only, I think, this was 83 or 93. 96 he won the Nationals. So he was what, like 22 or 23 or something. But he won the heavyweight class, and I never heard of him, and I was reading an article in Flex magazine. They had his leg routine, and his quads were so big, and he said in the article, he goes, I don't even squat. And I'm sitting there reading the magazine. My knees were sore from squatting so heavy. I go, my legs are half the size of this guy. God, what genetics,
It's a genetic thing is right.
Yeah. And he was wide. He had the wide shoulders, so.
Yeah.
He must have realized – I mean, I'm sure he was very passionate about bodybuilding, but I know Jay's a good businessman. God, he's worth millions of dollars now.
Yeah.
But he must have realized at a young age that if I do everything necessary to be a pro, I could probably make a really good living at this,
Well, I remember him entering, I don't remember what year it was, in the 90s. He entered one of the Night of the Champion shows in New York. He'd already turned, and he bombed out. He didn't do that well. And I remember him saying to me, he said the same thing that Nasser El Sambadi said to me right around the same time, a little bit earlier. Nasser's a couple of years before. Nasser, who for some reason wanted me to call him Jimmy. I don't know why, but
Jimmy?
That's what he asked me to call
him. Oh, that's funny.
The Night of the Champions and didn't even place in the top 15, right? And I saw him a couple of days later outside Gold's Gym. There was a bench right outside the gym. And I had spoken to him at the contest. And I sat next to him. Hey, Andy, how you doing, Jimmy? he says, Jerry, had that accent. Jerry, he says, I know that I didn't do well in this contest, but trust me, in about 4 or 5 years, I'll be one of the top 5 pros in the country. And I remember saying to him, I said, well, I believe it. I said, you're a big guy. All you got to do is refine your physique and I could see it.
Mm-hmm.
Said the same thing. He came up to me in the gym after he bombed out of the Night of the Champions. He said in about 2 or 3 years, I'm going to be like a top Mr. Olympia competitor. He didn't say Mr. Olympia, but he said he definitely would be in the top 3. He told me that.
Hmm.
They both of them, their wishes came true. What can I say?
Yeah, I remember Jay's first Olympia in 99. He was one of them. He placed almost last.
Yeah.
I don't think he should have. I was at that show, and that was the first year it was in Vegas. And I thought he had a great physique. I mean, I thought he definitely got overlooked.
I think that was around the same time that we had that conversation.
Okay.
He wasn't doing that great in the shows.
I think he won the Night of the Champions the next year in 2000. So I think that was the start of his, rise.
Yeah.
But he had to know, being that good at 19, he had to know that he had the genetics to go all the way,
Yeah, all they had to do was stick to it and refine it bigger. And the rest, and then that was the rest is history, as they say.
You're that big as a teenager, man.
He had these big bones and stuff, big structure.
Yeah.
With a lot of muscle on, You know what I mean? That famous shot of him on stage, you know the one where he's like, look, you know, he He has extending the one leg with
the quad stomp. Yeah.
That's a phenomenal shot.
Yeah, it is.
When I first saw that, I thought it was Photoshop.
I know.
I mean, even for Jay, that's a little too big. But
yeah, that was amazing.
Boy, he really looked.
Yeah, that's one of the best pictures in bodybuilding.
Oh, my God, did he look? He was a monster in that picture.
Yeah. And Branch Warren looked good, too. I mean, you remember Branch when he was younger? He had, I mean, he got sort of, I guess, blocky looking a little bit when he got really big, you know. But when he was younger, and even as an amateur when he was in the Nationals, he had a smaller waist and really good V-shape.
Yeah, as he put on size, that happens with some guys. And when they put on size, they start to get a little bit of a blockier look.
Yeah.
Plus, he was extremely vascular, and he looked very muscular. He used to win the most muscular a lot. You know, he had a very muscular-looking guy.
Yeah.
He was pretty strong, too, from what I understand. Didn't he have some sort of mishap before a show where he fell off a horse or something like that down in Texas?
Well, he tore his patella tendon slipping on ice.
Oh, was that it? Okay.
Yeah, and then he won the Arnold the next year. That was amazing, you know, that he was able to come back in less than a year and win. I mean, that was really phenomenal.
He married a female bodybuilder, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's a really, really hard worker. That guy's a, you know. Yeah.
I remember him seeing him training with, what's the name of that guy who died not long ago? He won the Nationals 1 year. He died of kidney failure. I can't remember his name.
Oh, Tom Prince?
Prince, that's it. Yeah. I saw them training at Gold's 1 year when they were both in top shape. Very heavy, monstrous training guys.
Yeah.
Phew, monstrous. Heavy weights and stuff. And jeez.
Branch is retired. He still trains like that, I think. He's still big. He's still really big.
Is he? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Jerry Branham for joining us on the show. I love having these discussions with Jerry at the end or the beginning of each year, I should say. We do it at the end of the year, but we really do it at the beginning. And Jerry loves doing it too. Support Jerry at his newsletter, AppliedMetabolics.com. It's only $10 a month. So if you guys go to AppliedMetabolics.com, you can support Jerry with your $10 a month donation to his newsletter. And this newsletter is huge. It comes out once a month, but it's like 30-something pages long. He works on it all month long. Great information on nutrition and training and some old school stories, the old school bodybuilders from the years when Jerry was involved with bodybuilding. All right. Before I let you guys go, I want to read this article that was sent to us by Jarrett Hulse. And it's about Lou Ferrigno from the 1994 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. Actually, it came out in March 1995, but it was about the 1994 Masters Mr. Olympia that Lou competed in. And it says, when fate has different plans, I came back to bodybuilding for one reason and one reason only, for my fans, by Lou Ferrigno as told to Bob Wolf. I have brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing will resist a will which stakes its existence upon its fulfillment. Quote from Benjamin Disraeli. Carla, come close to me, I whispered as we lay in bed together, holding each other in our embrace. Why is life so unfair? Came the words from my mouth. All my life I've had to overcome difficulty after difficulty, setback after setback. And now, just when I know, no, damn it, just when I believe that I finally reached the summit, life throws me another setback. Carla, how long will this go on? As she held me tighter, not a single word poured from her lips. It didn't have to. Knowing my soulmate understood my deepest fears, hurts, and frustrations gave an answer to me greater than the spoken word ever could. Those were some of my emotions the night before I became ill after drinking water contaminated by a virulent strain of bacteria. Surely 1,000 thoughts raced through my mind as I saw myself and all the struggles I had faced my entire life to get to where I am. The road to my success has never been easy, damn hard to put it nicely, but this year was going to be different. I knew it would. Good fortune was going to throw me a rope, and I was ready to grab it and enjoy the fruits of over 30 years of hard labor. The unseen destroyer. A few nights before I became ill, various news reports stated that a powerful bacterial strain had poisoned drinking water in different parts of the country. Some people had died from it. At times, the severity of my symptoms left me with such unconscionable thoughts as why I couldn't be so lucky.
The bug hit me 12 days before the Masters Mr. Olympia last September. Every time I put food in my stomach, I would have to throw up. At least 14 times during the night, I was up trying to eliminate this illness through any means I could. Joe Weider wanted me to shoot pictures with Chris Lund, but lying on the couch and moving my head took more energy from my 300-pound body than the heaviest squat workouts I had ever experienced. But despite the intense pain of being sick, despite the severe loss of energy, and despite hardly being able to stand up, I dragged myself into the gym every single day of my sickness. I would pose, do isotension and cardio every single night. It was so hard. All I wanted to do was lie down and rest, but I knew I couldn't. Not if I was to be the champion I knew I was. Lifting even the lightest weights took all the strength I could muster. To this day, I don't know how I did it, but I forced myself to lift the same heavy weights every workout. No sickness was going to stop me from winning the Masters Mr. Olympia. After each workout, my legs shook so badly I could barely walk to my car. Opening the car door seemed to take forever. Once inside, I'd lean back and want to sleep. No, I'd tell myself, you've got to get home, try to eat, and get some rest. Once I made it home and opened the door, I would literally fall down through the doorway and lie there for what seemed like hours. The first time it happened, Carla and the kids ran to me and cried out, "Let us help you." "Please leave me alone," were the only four words I could say. Lying on the floor and wanting to be left alone brought images to my mind of nature and how a wounded animal seeks out, to the exclusion of all else, solitude for healing. I knew I was like that animal. Few people knew what I was going through. Few people knew what I had to go through. Even fewer would understand. The sickness took a lot out of me. My muscles went flat. My strength and endurance vanished. I lost 18 pounds of muscle and I had no appetite. I tried to eat, but I couldn't. The mere thought of solid food made me want to throw up. My body felt like jelly. I was sick for more than 12 days. When Joe heard about my sickness, he called to see how I was doing. I told him how sick I was and that I didn't want to eat. The Master Blaster convinced me how important it was to get my strength and endurance back and that I didn't have much time. I didn't want to hear that, but Joe was right. I decided to use MegaMass 4000 to help support my strength and increase my weight before I reached the critical point of losing too much size, especially before the most important contest of my life. It worked. After a few days of not eating, I was finally able to keep down my shakes, and that helped me keep what little strength I had. Most important, it helped me to keep my muscle mass. When it came to my attitude about my sickness, I had two choices: feel sorry for myself and use it as an excuse, or to not do my best, or realize that if I had to get sick, it was better to do it before the show and not on the day of the show. I chose the latter. Throughout the sickness, one thought kept playing in my mind. Nothing can hold you back, Lou. This is your year. You will be crowned champion. 25 years ago, I trained with my buddy Ira. I vividly remember how we pushed each other to the limit. We thought alike. We trained alike. We had that chemistry and fire in our blood to bring out the best in each other. Over the years, I had lots of training partners, but no one pushed me like Ira did. He's the only one who can push my button. I can't bullshit him. He's the only one who can drive me to the ground. I knew if I was to be the absolute best shape of my life, I would need to have Ira as my training partner once again. We made an agreement. Whatever he said I needed to do to get ready for the show, I would do, and I wouldn't fight him. Preparing for the Masters Mr. Olympia, I trained harder than I ever had in my life. I knew I wasn't competing against guys 20 years younger with superior genetics. After learning from all the mistakes I had made during my last 2 years of preparations for the Mr. Olympia, I thought I would do everything right this year. I trained so hard I had to go to the chiropractor 3 times a week. I went through every pain, every injury, because my whole goal was to prove that life begins at 40. I wanted to show the world that at 42 years of age, I was in the best shape of my life. Mentally, I prepared an entire year for this event. On the day of the show, I felt I finally hit everything right on the mark. It all came down to what I did years ago, and that was trusting myself. Not just going by other people's advice, but putting my whole heart and soul into my training and listening to my gut feelings. My training for the Masters Mr. Olympia was different than my preparations for the 92 and 93 Mr. Olympias. We trained 3 days on and 1 day off. Instead of training lighter and doing supersets, I trained heavier and heavier as I got closer to the show. On the fourth set of every exercise, I'd go to failure and literally drop the weight on the floor while my muscles couldn't move another inch. Ira pushed me harder than I'd ever been pushed in my life. In my squat workout, I'd usually work up to 315 pounds for 8 reps. then 405 for 12 reps. Training with Ira, he'd yell, "Come on, Louis, one more set." I'd look at him in disbelief and tell him he was crazy. I don't know what it was, but hearing him say that after I was totally exhausted made me really mad. I felt I went to the limit, and I couldn't think I could move another rep. The more I thought about it, the angrier I got. The part of me said I couldn't and shouldn't do it, yet the bigger part of me told me to dig deeper and keep pushing myself to the limit. I was determined to do it, to hell with it. I knew if I pushed myself a step beyond with whatever energy and power I had left, that it would give me more growth and power. Many times I would do another set of 15 reps with 405 with all the strength I had inside me. I trained using heavy weights, perfect form, and no bullshit. Each workout took less than 90 minutes, 12 sets per body part, with the greatest intensity I could muster. My diet had to change. For the first time before a competition, I was eating meat. This helped give my body the protein and nutrients it lacked. I made sure my diet was well-balanced and complete. I ate 6 meals each day, kept my water intake high, and maintained the calories at 3,700 per day. I did cardio work and ignored the old idea that you should do 2 hours of cardio per day, eat 5,000 calories, and come in at maximum size. I concentrated on keeping my lines and looking in the mirror and very slowly trimming the fat off. This approach worked so well, and my body fat was coming off so fast, I didn't need extra aerobics. I have no doubt it was the heavy, intense training that was responsible for the big change in my physique. After 30 years, I had finally found the perfect balance of training, diet, and rest. I was amazed at how fast my body grew. I trained less this year than I had ever trained before. Training only once a day was all I needed, with my cardio work at night, to make my muscles unfold with never seen before mass cuts and separation. Every fourth day, I rested completely. When I started to see the gains, I felt like the old Lou. Almost instantly, the feelings of training and winning 2 Mr. Universe titles came rushing back to me. It was as if all the years had never passed. I was filled with incredibly powerful feelings as my body began to change. I knew that come the day of the show, the judges would have to give me the title of Masters Mr. Olympia. I would be so much better, the best ever, and I would stand on stage and be so overpowering that no one could touch me. When I came home after every workout, I was happy. I kept saying to Carla and the kids, "This is it. This is going to be my year." I could feel it. I never trained so hard. I was on top of the world and loved it. My mental preparation was unbelievable. I'd never been more focused. For this first ever Masters Mr. Olympia, I wanted to step on stage and have people say, "Look at Lou. He's 42. He's better than he was at 41. I wanted to show people that Lou Ferrigno was a phenomenon. With age, he keeps getting better and better. I wanted them to know that age isn't a barrier to getting in the best shape of their life. I wanted to beat last year's condition by 50%. I wanted to come in like everyone expected, hard and chiseled like Hercules, but bigger and better. For me, it all came down to my mental approach. For the first time in my life, I let go of the fear of my conscious mind overriding my gut feelings of what I always knew was right. I became a kid again. I let go of trying to prove to my dad that his son was worthy and a champion. I was doing the Masters Mr. Olympia for me and for the love of my fans. This time, people were going to see me with beautiful symmetry, perfectly proportioned, and with a small waist. People were going to see my back as my best body part and not my worst, like it was in Helsinki at the 1992 Mr. Olympia. Finally, everyone was going to see Lou the way Lou wanted to be seen, at his all-time best. Working my legs with heavy weight was never something I enjoyed. This year, I did it, and I grew like never before. Another obstacle was breaking through the pain barrier and not quitting when my body begged me to stop. Probably the biggest obstacle I conquered was my posing. For 2 hours every day for 3 months, I worked myself to death on comparison poses and using the Weider isotension principle. During the first few weeks, I hated to pose, and I did just isotension. I just hated it, but I knew I had to do it if I wanted to be at my all-time best. Then a strange thing happened. I began to see my body changing, becoming harder. For the first time, I was in total control of my muscles, like they were responding like never before. Soon I was actually looking forward to leaving the gym and going home to work on my isotension. I was doing more than 800 reps a day, flexing and tensing my legs, which increased their size. I couldn't believe it. I was determined to do everything in my power to win. Posing, diet, training, mental preparation, and rest. Nothing would be left to chance. I made up my mind that nothing was going to stop me. I would be ready. To become the champion I knew I was, I went back to my roots. I did the things that made me a champion more than 20 years ago. I was also in the process of writing my book, and as I wrote it, a lot of anger that was bottled up inside me all these years came out. I focused that anger on my workouts, and I experienced a training intensity like I'd never known. As for other obstacles, I've already mentioned how sick I became 11 days before the show. Then 4 days before the show, I broke my toe. Luckily, it happened so close to the contest that most of my training was behind me. Still, I was in so much pain I could barely walk. The only cardio work I could do was ride the bike barefoot. With all the mental power I had, I masked the pain just so I could walk on stage. I was so determined that I would be my best come September 9th, 1994, and I can say this with all sincerity, that if I had been hit by a car, I would have found a way to walk again and get to the gym and train. My training was the most important thing to me, and nothing and nobody was going to stop me. After I made the decision to let go of my fears that were holding me back and from achieving my all-time best condition, my life seemed to click together. Everything fell into place. Finally, there was a calm in my life that I had never known. On the day of the show, I knew I had accomplished my goal, despite the waterborne illness and the broken toe. I was in the best shape of my life. I couldn't have done any more. And for the first time, I realized I had taken myself to the limit. I asked myself if I had to do it all over again, could I have done any more? The answer was no. For the first time in my life, I found peace within, but that peace wouldn't last long. Everything changed the moment I stepped on stage for the first round of comparisons. Almost immediately, I sensed something was terribly wrong. My tanning lotion had been applied by a friend who put it on too dark. I looked like something out of an Al Jolson movie. During the prejudging, my tanning oil began to streak all over my body. What else could go wrong, I wondered. I looked and felt awful. Yet despite the prejudging tanning snafu, I felt the real problem was that I wasn't being appreciated for the improvements I had made. When I first walked on stage, the fans were excited, and so was I. I was ready to be named the winner, right then and there. I didn't even give a thought to Robbie or Boyer or any of the other guys. I was there in my own world, in my best shape ever. I knew inside that it would only be a matter of hours before Joe Weider would walk over to me on stage, hand me the Sandow, and shake my hand. But like the wind, those feelings quickly changed when I looked at the judges. The images reflected back into my eyes from them drowned out any applause from the fans. I looked at the judges again and in a split second thought, oh shit, what's going on here? The judges didn't have to say a word. I could see it from their expressions on their faces. I could feel it all over my body. And then no matter how hard I tried, I wouldn't be able to get their attention. I realized that these were the same judges who had judged me over the past 2 years. I believe they had their favorites. As pictures will show, during the prejudging, the tanning solution really began to run badly. This was quickly corrected for the evening show, yet I felt that the tanning problem was just the excuse the judges needed to knock points off my score. Even though they didn't have to say it, I could hear their excuses. Sorry, Louis, we wanted to place you higher, but your tanning wasn't up to par, and we had no other choice but to dock your score. Back at the hotel after the prejudging, I was nervous. I told myself I had to go all out at the evening show and give it my all. On the elevator, one of the judges told me that it was close. I thought, close? How can it be close? I knew I was bigger, harder, and more separated than anyone else. Suddenly, my job was cut out for me. At the evening show, I had to be a sensation. Before I went on stage that night, I remembered that Sergio Oliva and Arnold Schwarzenegger went through what I was going through, and they came out winners. They were champions and not losers. Knowing that helped still my fears inside me and gave me the added confidence to believe that despite the show being close, I would be named champion. At the evening show, when they announced Boyer Co. third, a big sense of relief flooded me. I knew that I'd done it. I couldn't wait to receive the standout. I actually did it. Any second, they would announce Lou Ferrigno, Masters Mr. Olympia, and the whole crowd was going to stand and applaud. All right, so I guess that's it. It seemed like that was a part one, but I think that's the only 6 pages Jared sent me. So I don't know if there was a part two to this article, but I'll ask Jared if he could send me that, because it seems like it kind of ends abruptly when Lou did end up getting second place in the contest behind Robbie. And I know he was very, very disappointed. So I didn't know he went through all that with getting the sick, with the bacterial virus, and then also breaking his toe. That was an interesting article. I didn't know like Lou went through all that. But yeah, he was very, very disappointed. I believe that was Lou's last contest because he did the 92 and 93 Olympias, as he mentioned. He didn't place that well. I think he was like 8th or 10th or something like that. But he was competing against younger guys, like he said, And that was his first time back since 1975. So it was a long layoff, almost 20 years. And then this was the show that he knew for sure he was going to win. And then he ended up taking second to Robbie. And I think Robbie just had better overall shape with the smaller waist, wider shoulders. At least that's what it looked like from the pictures. So, but that was an interesting article. All right, Jarrett, thank you for sending us that. All right, guys, that's all we got for this week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll be back next week with Jerry Branham again, where we'll talk about 1993 and review part two. And we will talk about all the professional contests except for the Mr. Olympia, but we'll talk about the pro Ironman that Flex Wheeler won on his pro debut. And then we'll talk about the great Arnold Classic that took place that year in 1993. And then we'll also talk about the Night of the Champions and several of the other Grand Prix shows that took place that year. So it'll be another great discussion. All right, guys, have a great week. Train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.